Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. In continuing your appeal to heaven, we want to continue providing you with the content that is necessary so that we can become more efficacious in what we're seeking to do and in our actions. Okay, so using some words to try to help concise this message so that we can get into content. And again, the whole point, folks, it's not about GR. It's really not. Reclaiming the Republic is only like an appliance. If you understand what a router does, if you understand networking, it is basically an appliance that connects everybody to everything. And so that's all we're trying to do, with giving you the content so that we're all on the same wavelength, on the same network, and focused on full compliance to the Constitution. If we don't understand the Constitution and how it was defined by the framers, then we're doing a complete disservice, because all we're doing is we're allowing all of these people who've been redefining it and creating this abomination that we have. The only way to get back to it is to get back to how it was truly defined, which is why we're reading the Constitution every year this time of year. We started off on September 17th, which is Constitution Day. And we've got Sean with us, and welcome back, Sean. And with Sean, right? Sean, we're covering from Article 1, actually the preamble of the Constitution, and we're going to go through every line, even through all of the amendments. Oh, by the way, Sean, I didn't tell you this, but we're going to be covering amendments that never got ratified. Do you know why?
No, sir.
Okay. That's important to help you understand why we're going to do this, because we can learn a lot from amendments that did not get ratified. And when we get to them, I'm going to show you precisely how, because when some of these amendments that were written by the framers, like the Thomas Jefferson Amendment, it's very insightful to go, oh, wow, he was trying to give the federal government the ability to do something that they didn't have in the Constitution, and yet the federal government started doing that, and they never passed the Constitution, or they never passed the amendment to do it. In other words, they don't care. They just assume there's nobody stopping them anymore, because they're just doing what they want to. And that's happening in all three branches, and they're all running interference for each other so that they can continually get away with it. The only problem that we have, or the only thing that we see that's actually, I think, the entertainment of this entire fiasco, is watching it ebb and flow between conservative and from morality to moral turpitude. There we go. That's using the same term. Morality and moral turpitude are the complete abandonment of morality. And so, anyway, there we go. So, we were covering Article 1, Section 10. And what I did was I took Section 10 and I broke it into sub-context. In other words, I broke down each of the sub-clauses that no state shall, and then shall do this. No state shall do this. No state shall do that. Way, I think it's very simple for people to start digesting what's all in that one paragraph. And what we ended up covering last was no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. And then kind of went down this long explanation of, you know, digital currency, electronic, and why. Did we cover why? How the states were using paper money to inflate and basically steal the property of the people that lived in the state?
Yes, sir.
And in so doing, Rhode Island, and I don't know if I brought up Rhode Island, but Rhode Island, as they were called by the framers, Rogue Island, Rhode Island
literally inflated their currency. They did like what Germany did. They inflated it to a point where it was absolutely worthless. The paper was, it was cheaper to burn their currency than it was firewood, practically, just like what Germany did. And so when the Rogue Island paid their debt to the Continental Congress, it was almost like, here you go, there's nothing. You know, now your problem is, what are you going to do with all this paper because it's worthless? Anywho, so the next one that we're going to cover is F, which is basically the same thing with an added line to it. And so this is the passing of Bill of Attainders and so forth. So let's go ahead and dive into that one. And we'll keep all three kind of as a part of the context of this. So go ahead and read that one, if you would, please.
No state shall pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts.
And so the one difference that we haven't covered already is creating laws that are impairing the obligation of contracts. Now, the federal government does not have the ability to create a law obligating contracts, but they did. What would be a law that would be obligating contracts? I'll give you a good case in point. In 2006 is probably better than 2006. In 2006, when the currency started melting, our economy hit the bubble. Remember that?
I do.
Do you remember what caused that? What caused that bubble to break?
The housing crisis. I mean, they were making bets. They lowered the standards for the mortgages, and then they made bets on people defaulting on the mortgages.
It was a running joke that they said that they could get a mortgage to a cow.
Right.
Anybody and everybody qualified. So in other words, they were handing out money left and right. And so all of these mortgages started collapsing. Banks collapsed. And this started in 2006. It flowed into the 2008. And actually, it was Jimmy Carter that really put this all in motion by creating the CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act. And it was Bill Clinton that put energy or started putting fuel into the CRA, because they used the CRA to actually start providing these not merit-based, but like affirmative action into home loans to make sure that even though you don't have good credit and you don't have the ability to, you know, you're at a high risk, the government was going to still back you, or forcing institutions to still give you loans. And it was just crazy. I mean, if you're not mature enough to, I mean, the whole point of debt and everything else, because when we look at, you know, paying that obligation, right, then the bottom line is that if you can't pay it, then what happens? Well, you go into bankruptcy. Now, back in the framers' day, what happened if you went bankrupt? Do you know?
They took all your stuff.
Actually, you went to jail.
Right?
The debtor's prison. Did you know that a Supreme Court justice was pulled from the bench and actually put into debtor's prison?
I did not know.
Did not know, because people didn't know. Oh, and it was such an embarrassment. And, oh, it was, you know, we can't be that cruel. We got to be nicer. We've gotten so nice that we've literally let the devil into our bedrooms, into our living rooms, and throughout our house. And this is the problem. An enlightened society is a disciplined society. And this is unfortunately, they don't teach tenets of enlightenment. But an enlightened society acknowledges that this behavior is destructive to an individual, to their community, and to society as a whole. I'll give you a good case in point. Anything that's addictive. Anything that is addictive is destructive. It's destructive to the individual, destructive to the family, it's destructive to the community as well as society. Go through anything, gambling, go through drugs, alcohol, sex. It doesn't matter. If it's addictive, it is destructive. And so we as a society should do everything we can to help educate ourselves and help basically purge addictive things and that behavior out of our society. And the way to do that is discipline and education. So as we look at this in laws of impairing, and we talked about the 2006 meltdown going into 2008, what ended up happening is it rippled into the auto industry. Remember that? And it also it rippled into the insurance industries. And these insurance industries, or I should say companies, became worthless. And so what did the federal government do? They had the TARP bailout. And the TARP bailout went strictly into these insurance agencies. In other words, they, instead of following the law, so what's supposed to happen if all of a sudden, you know, a insurance company can't pay, you know, on their on the claims and everything else? Of course, a lot of people get hurt, but what happens?
Everything goes back to where it was before, I guess.
Yeah, the people that are running the business get fired. The business goes out of business, and people have to move to a more solvent, better functioning, better managed insurance company. Because apparently the people that were running that insurance company was playing a lot of games, and most of those people should have gone to jail. But instead, this idea of too big to fail became the mantra. We got to go out and we got to save these people. Those people should have done the perp walk. So right. That's just that, right? So stepping in and bailing somebody out is not what the government's supposed to do. Secondly, with the auto industry, when the auto industry, because see the auto industry and even the insurance companies, and the auto companies, they had shares, right? They're shareholders. When you look at, what was it, Merrill Lynch, and I forget all the different names, but I know GM and Chrysler were two big American manufacturers that had real problems. And the government chose, now we already covered in Section 9 that they're not supposed to be playing favorites, right? So technically, Chrysler could have came around and said, you gave them a favorite where you didn't give it to us. And actually, this is really where it gets really ugly, nasty, and unconstitutional, because the Obama administration actually allowed the violation of contract law by stepping into Chrysler and saying, you are not going to get paid, not just shareholders, but bondholders. Now, when you look at investments and you understand stocks is a high risk, but the bond, that means these people are actually buying a low risk investment, but they're buying the foundation of the company. If the company becomes insolvent, the bondholders will get their money. They're guaranteed by contract that everything will have to go to foreclosure, and they may not get every penny on the dollar, but they'll get the closest thing to that, and the shareholders get what's left.
Right. They're the first.
Yes. And what Obama did was he tore all that concept up and he just said, you no longer have bonds. You no longer have shares. This is now a company that's granted to fiat. If you look at what he did, he literally bypassed and violated the law with his action as a king, where he had no authority to do that. The government has no authority to get involved in corporations, contract law, and those types of things. And that was so tyrannical. That right there is one act alone that he should have been impeached for. And because we don't understand the Constitution, as a matter of fact, Obama should be impeached for so many different things that, you know, when he does die and, you know, they bury him, you know, if they pass a law that we're going to dig you up in effigy for every offense, then there probably won't be much left of him after the, you know, after everybody's gotten their pound of flesh in the burnings of his, you know, his corpse by, you know, burning him in effigy. Because he's been that bad and that unconstitutional and that treasonous as a president. So, and, you know, he was not the only one. He, technically, when you look at the things he did, he actually leverage things that FDR did and what these other people put in place. I mean, he knew where these fulcrums were that were put in place by FDR and all these bad presidents, and he went out and exploited them. So anyway, I try to help people understand that this whole impairing, this is a restriction placed on states. The only reason they didn't put this on there is because technically the federal government had no authority over contract law. They weren't to set up contracts. They weren't to, you know, get involved in those types of things. They were to pay for, and eventually what ended up happening was they would create contracts of basically you were buying this and you deliver that, right? And so in buying guns and in buying goods, but they didn't start doing that and for quite a while. And what ended up happening is they actually started creating purchase agreements and purchase contracts for defense and those types of things. But, and that was kind of necessary. But the fact is that this should have also equally applied, that the fact that they started creating rules or going down this path of impairing contracts. I bet when you look at Teddy Roosevelt, he equally stepped on the impairing of contract obligations and so forth when he started going after trust busting and all of that, because the federal government had no business in doing that. No business. The federal government had no business in regulating those corporations in the first place when they started doing that even 10, 20 years before. So this right here is a hard obligation where the state can't get involved in impairing the obligation of contracts, period. In other words, once it's in a contract. Now, let me ask you this, though, because this is interesting. Let me say you live in an HOA, or you're moving into an HOA, and the HOA has this contract of they saying, you know, we're going to stipulate, you know, the things that are suitable for your property and in your home and so forth and so on. And you sign this contract. And then down the road, they add as one of those things that is stipulated that you cannot possess in your home is a firearm. Now, the way you signed a contract, can the state actually enforce that contract?
I would think not, since it's a constitutionally protected right.
Ah, when we go into the 14th Amendment, that one amendment that most all conservatives and progressives hate alike. You know, it's interesting how politics has interesting bedfellows, right? When you look at the 14th Amendment, Section 1, this is what it says. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. So in other words, now we're looking at an HOA, right? So if an HOA created a contract and then says, hey, we had a contract and we want to basically pursue the enforcement of this contract because we know you have firearms, you got to get rid of them, and they take you to court. The state itself, if they actually allow you to be stripped of your firearms by enforcing that, I'll give you even a better case. Let me take it so it's not so wow. That's really obvious. You can't have chickens.
Yeah.
Not for health purposes, because it just doesn't go with the kind of community we want to have. You can't have chickens. And when you move in, you had no problem with that being there. But all of a sudden, you lost your job, you know, sickness, whatever, and you're just struggling to survive. And so you create a chicken coop, and you start growing your own food and having some animals for self-preservation and survival. And they come in and say, sorry, you can't do that. Is that not a constitutional right to survive?
I would think so.
Absolutely it is.
You have a right to life.
Absolutely it is. And as a matter of fact, when they come to try to enforce that law to actually have the sheriff take that from you, then you can actually say, hey, you're violating my rights. And sheriff, if you actually take this, then you're actually violating my rights as well by enforcing a law that's abridging my privileges and immunities. In other words, just because it's in a contract, does it become legally binding, bar anything? As a matter of fact, the Ninth Amendment kind of speaks to this very specific concept. The enumeration in the Constitution, let's just say, instead of constitution, the enumeration in a contract of certain rights shall not be construed. In other words, the HOA has these rights over dictating you. In other words, there's an enumeration in a contract. It's just not even in the Constitution, in the contract, that says they have these certain rights to dictate how to color, you know, how to paint your home or what have you. You're not actually held to that, because it says right here, shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So you always have your property rights. You can do with your property with what you want. You may have signed a contract, but that contract cannot be enforced in the United States. It is unconstitutional and immoral to try to inflict standards upon people that would absolutely violate their rights. How about that? So when we diving into this laws impairing obligations, there's some caveats to this, and the 14th Amendment created one of those caveats, okay? And so the last one is the grant of any title of nobility. So the states couldn't create, so it's interesting, the federal government could create titles of nobility, and the federal government and the states had this kind of same restriction. So this was kind of important. They brought this up twice now, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and I think we may find that in Article 4, we actually may find this concept of privileges, immunities, those types of things. Maybe not the, well, I think it's reciprocity that comes up in 4. So anyway, nonetheless, let's move to subsection 2. So now Article 1, Section 10, subsection 2. Go ahead, let's do that one.
No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports, except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws and the net produce of all duties and imposts laid by any state on imports or exports shall be for the use of the Treasury of the United States, and all such laws shall be subject to the revision and control of the Congress.
Okay, so when we're looking at the imposts and duties, that means things that are coming in from foreign ports. So that second part was really towards the foreign stuff. States could not tax foreign goods, except no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports. Now, it included exports. Except what may be necessary for executing its inspection laws, and there's this other part because it gets into 3, and so go ahead and let's read 3 now.
No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in time of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war, unless actually invaded, or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay.
Okay, so these two are kind of tied together, and I'm not sure if it's really two, just the way this is kind of worded, if this is really just one subsection, but they created two. And so when you look at what a state can do and how they can create these imposts or duties, it would be by basically, because it says right here, lay any duty of tonnage. So in other words, New York, Virginia, they were, and Massachusetts, Boston, and Norfolk, the three ports, right? The three big ports, Norfolk, New York, and Boston. These were the Hummers. Now we're going into a break here. And so with that, that means we'll have to take a pause. But, you know, I think everybody kind of knows where I'm going. I want to get into the details of it because putting the details together helps, I think, this become really crystal clear in how these two sections are kind of joined a bit. But anyway, we will be right back after this very short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we're going to get back into the marrying between subsection 2 and 3, because looking at Boston, New York, and Norfolk, right, these are the three ports that are moving a lot of volume. Where is all that tonnage, where is all those goods coming from and going? Now, a lot of it is going to be used right there in Virginia, Massachusetts, and New York, right?
Yes, sir.
But not exclusive. As a matter of fact, Pennsylvania, the farmers of Pennsylvania will be pushing their products through New York, going out their port, right? So this is where New York has this ability to add an administrative fee when they can create an actual wear and tear to the use of their thoroughfares, in other words, the roadways, as well as the port facilities themselves. Because everybody knows that, you know, every time you drive down the road, it creates a little bit of wear and tear. And it's very marginal for an individual vehicle, but when you're taking big, heavy tractor trailers, that type of stuff, it becomes a little more, but it's still marginal. It's like, you know, the road's going to fall apart tomorrow or even in a year, right? Because the
dirt depends where you live.
Right, yeah, absolutely. There you go. And it depends on the amount of the tonnage and so forth. But they've gotten to the ability to say once enough tonnage, because this goes back to the Audubon we talked about yesterday. Once you put this amount of tonnage across it, then it will start needing repair and replacement. They've been able to calculate this stuff, which is why the brilliance of the Germans in creating a road and a road system that is impervious to that. Now let me ask you this. When you look at the state of New York, and when you look at the state of Virginia and these big port states, California, Louisiana, and the Pacific Northwest, Seattle, because I think those are the primary states of major commerce coming in and out, right? New York being a primary. I think Boston maybe. It's a small player compared to New York. I think Virginia still is a prime player. New Orleans or Louisiana, California, and Washington. Is that about right? Because all the world commerce comes through those five ports, whatever, right?
Correct.
A lot of it. I mean, the majority of all of it. It's like, you know, it's less than 5% that goes through these other ports. Because it's just Houston. Pardon me, what's that?
Houston is number one.
Oh, Houston's number one in the United States today?
Correct.
Really? It's number one over California?
It is. Los Angeles is number nine. Houston, South Louisiana, Corpus Christi, New York, and New Jersey, New Orleans, Long Beach, Baton Rouge, Beaumont, Los Angeles, and Virginia.
Okay. All right. There you go. So those are the primary ports. Those are the states now. I didn't realize Houston became that big of a port. I didn't see that as, because I thought the majority of our trade was going to China. and coming from China. I didn't think Houston was had that kind of access to Chinese ships. But anyway, I know that we do have a lot of trade coming in and out of the United States. Nevertheless, the whole point is this, is that those states that are receiving that, let's think about it. If they have the ability to employ, because this goes back to efficiencies. If we create such a great efficiency that we don't have to employ these people every 4 or 5 years, or we create it in a way that we deploy them so that we can kind of maintain their employment because the job that they do is marginal enough that we keep them full-time employed. Does that make sense? In other words, they'll be working in one segment of the state to fixing these roads, and they have a rotation, and by the time they're wrapping up on the final segments of the state, they have to go back to the beginning because the quality of the road that they made requires replace and repair, right?
Correct.
Okay. And so this creates, this is the proverbial self-licking ice cream cone, right? Okay. Now, I know people look at that and go, well, that's my job. Well, okay, that's your job. And we look at jobs like that and go, is this a job we want to actually continually maintain? Because it just costs everybody. Why don't we, you know, take pride in doing it right the first time? This is why I go back to do it right the first time. Anyway, for what it's worth, though, they can actually collect a tonnage because the cost of throughput goes up. And so because labor goes up and the cost of everything continues to rise. If you build it so that it's impervious to the wear and tear, where the maintenance on it is actually so marginal that you go, huh, why didn't we do it that way? Then everybody saves. And everybody is freed up to go do other good things, or at least as we have to build new highways and expand, because in the Audubon, they're not done. They always have to build new, and it's growing, and it's continually grown. Do they need to have the immensity of building new roads all the time? You know, this goes back to the infrastructure money that we pour out. Look at our bridges. Look at, you know, the infrastructure, how sad it is, just because back in those days, we built it to a certain standard. We're still building it to a low standard. It's better, and it's new, and it'll last us, what, another 60 years, whatever that is. It's not something that will actually, you know, kind of last for an infinite amount of time or an incredible amount of time where we're getting the most out of our investment. The point is right here, there's a revenue that becomes an ability for government to create a reward system. Now, here's the other thing. All the states that are next to these border or these port states, they have a lot of tonnage going through them, traversing on their highways to the next state, right? Which means that every state gets to play this game. This becomes almost a Ponzi scheme. And this becomes this huge, how much added, because we've created this type of system, is added to the cost of, you know, our consuming goods and so forth. I'm just saying that as a society, this may be a good business model for everybody to, you know, make for themselves. It's a self-serving thing. But as a society, I would think that we would be better off, and as an enlightened society, to try to be as efficacious as possible. But 9 times out of 10... people don't want to do that at their own expense. In other words, I don't want to take a pay cut, or I don't want to have to get a different job. Anyway, this is there's a word for it, and I'm trying to think about the devil in the details. There we go. That's the best one. But anyway, going through 2 again, and it talks about these duties. And other than that's what absolutely necessary, and again, it's the same thing with the tonnage, that's really what this is talking about, that the states can't play commercial warfare on other states by saying, we're going to add a profit so that we're making revenue. No, they can only cover their costs. That's the whole point. And so this is why it's gone kind of crazy the way they do it. And if we actually had a transportation council that had nothing to do with the federal government, then the entire infrastructure of interstates between each other wouldn't be managed by the federal government. It'd be managed by we, the people in the states. And maybe at that point, we would start creating Autobahn types of systems, as well as, you know, instead of allowing ourselves to be, hijacked by what I would call the needs of the international community. Because why is it that we're still using fossil fuels? Why is it we're still doing things? Because I'm not talking about, you know, solar, windmills, and so forth. I'm just saying that there are ways, energy-wise and so forth, that we could have easily broken out of the global model. It's because it's almost like we owe the world to buy the crap so that they can continually make money on us. I'd love to get to the day where we can tell everybody that's got oil, where we don't need it anymore. You can still choose to use it and run it on your vehicle, but there's better. Water's a much better way. Hydrogen's a much better way. And you can use it in your same engine. My point is, and I've really gotten on a soapbox, so let me step down from this. My point is that with the states being able to work together from a bottom up, I believe we would actually come to the best conclusions that would serve our needs energy-wise, infrastructure-wise, and so forth, where we wouldn't be influenced by international needs and everybody else and the corporate deals that are happening. But that means that we have to take our governments back and get governments back into scope. There's no such thing as national government regulations in this Constitution. Have we read that yet? No. The government that controls the commerce is the state government. If Walmart wants to operate in every state has the ability to create their own regulations of how they want to regulate out-of-state businesses and classify them. This would force states to actually have to dance more to the needs of every state than it would be to basically try to get the federal government so that they can reach a better profit line. And so I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said for the design of this Constitution, because it empowers the states to incredible levels. And the states, if they actually woke up and took this power back in understanding how to manage the strategies of energy, commerce, and all of these types of things, we would be head and shoulders over every nation in the world. And nobody could even compete with us. It's almost like the perfect monopoly. Have you ever heard of a perfect monopoly?
No, I've not heard of a perfect
monopoly. Okay, have you ever heard of Alcoa?
The aluminum company?
Aluminum, yeah. So if you look at Alcoa and you do the research, Alcoa was a perfect monopoly. And they were existing. And it wasn't until the other alloy mining companies, you know, said, hey, this is unfair. We can't beat these guys, because they had such domain knowledge in mining and refining aluminum that nobody could enter into their market. You should look at that, because everybody was benefiting, because Alcoa was a very conscientious business where they were serving their customer and giving their customer the best price and the best product. And because that was their mission, their motto, it was all about keeping their costs down, keeping their profits down, so that the customers benefited the most. And they made it so that nobody could penetrate their market. And these other corporations said, that's an unfair monopoly. In other words, what had to happen is the government had to step in and say, you have to increase your prices to your customer. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You have to do bad to the people you've been serving so that these corporations can now get a piece of the pie. Go look at that, and you'll see how evil government getting involved in monopolies, they are the antithesis. I mean, when you look at the evil monopolies, it is government. Government is the evil monopoly. When you actually have good business people doing really good business decisions that are really serving people, and you have a good monopoly like that, you know, you're actually serving the community. That's an enlightened company. And at that point in time, they were actually operating under government regulations, because by that point in time, government was regulating commerce within the states and so forth. Unconstitutionally, I might add. But anyway, that's what they were doing. So I think this kind of wraps up, other than this last part, this one outlier that says this in the yellow text of the red in the very bottom. You see that? So let's go through that again, and I'm going to read it. It basically says that no state shall enter into, because I'm going to pass all this other stuff, enter into any agreement or compact with another state. So this is where that line has to change. This is where the Constitution should allow states to create compacts for serving the union domestically, because it is the state's job to take care of this domestic matters. So allowing the states to work together is at a benefit of the union, but by forcing the federal government to regulate and manage it, who actually manages the external stuff, this is why they have this, I'll just say, a conflict of interest. Why they actually can be the bad guy to say, hey, you know, we'll go ahead and sell out our own country and we'll tap our own oil wells so that you guys make more money by creating environmental regulations for us to do this, where we know that you're not applying it. If you see what I'm saying, this is how they've been actually conducting and playing warfare, because they're controlling all this crap. But right here, I believe this is where the language of an amendment, and God forbid the convention of states actually pick this up, because then they'd actually have a real amendment that would actually solve a real problem where the Constitution is holding us back from the states being able to work together. But the fact of the matter is that this right here is not a silver bullet. This allows us to go into the 21st century. What is only going to truly allow us to get across that threshold is holding the federal government accountable to this Constitution and getting them back into the scope and framework of the Constitution in full compliance. That is our priority. That's got to be job one. And then we can have the conversations of what do we need to do now that we've crossed this threshold to get us into the 52nd century. You know, what do we need to do for, you know, getting us way down, you know, beyond, well beyond what we can even fathom. And so moving on, it basically says, nor can a state make a compact with a foreign power or engage in war. And this is the part that is very important. So no state can engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as it will not admit of delay. So here's the question. If Louisiana and Florida feel that the invasion and the federal government's not doing their job, that they should be able to deploy their militia and start rounding people up and deporting them. The problem is we've got too many states that are enabling this invasion and enabling this warfare, this insurgency against the Constitution by keeping people, because the Constitution demands invaders be removed, because it literally includes invaded. So when we go up to Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 14, Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Here's the second term that's come up regarding the invasion process. So in other words, it was so important that the federal government be able to execute and repel an invasion, they even laid it out here that the states could do this. And then when we get to Article 4, it comes up again. In other words, the concept of dealing with an invasion is not light thinking by the framers. They understood the dangers of mass migration. They understood the dangers of people coming here that have no allegiance to this nation. And that's what Madison literally said. Your invaders could actually, they don't have to be military. They could be political, and they're just as bad, if not worse. But political invader has every intent. That's exactly what Mohammedans are. They're theocratic political invaders. They want to take over us politically and religiously. They're even telling us this. And nobody wants to actually...
Right out in the open.
Go ahead. Actually, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I was just saying, they say it right out in the open, just like in Minnesota right now, what's going on, Detroit, other places like that. I did want to make one comment about the states making compacts. What we have here for hurricane evacuation is they've made agreements with Mississippi, and I don't know if we have one with Texas, but we definitely have one with Mississippi as far as the evacuation routes go, where if the storm's coming into the state of Louisiana and we need to evacuate, they help us or have an agreement with us that they're going to make both sides of the 10 one way out of the state, and 55 one way out of the state, and 59, I think, one way out of the state.
Right.
Would that have anything to do with what we're talking about here with them entering into an agreement or a compact with another state?
Yeah,
considering that the federal government thinks they have the authority to regulate transportation.
Yeah, so you got to remember that back in those days, you know, that was well beyond their scope of understanding mass movement, quick movement, of those types of things. Now that we're in that ability, the bottom line, the framework literally keeps states from being able to create those types of coordinations, because if they allow it in one way, then that's why this needs to be framed in a way so that states, for domestic purposes, can actually benefit each other by creating compacts, councils, and even, you know, confederations, if they, you know, if the states want to do that. As a matter of fact, this is what I would do. Let's just say the states want to create a Department of Education, and they actually want every state to have an apportionment of taxation and everything else. So the states can create this council. The council can come up with the amount of money that they think they would need. And actually, education is really bad because it means to be eradicated, and we need to completely reinvent education altogether. And we can talk about that at another time. But let's talk about infrastructure, the Department of Transportation, energy, all those things that kind of communications, all those things that fall under infrastructure, and say, we want to, you know, because the federal government, you're not doing that anymore. Now all the states have to do it. They could actually, they need to amend so they can create this council, and then they would create, this council would come forth with an amendment that basically says, we're going to empower you to tax a certain amount of money to give us, because the money would literally, they would tax the states, and that money would basically be given to them to meet their needs. And what they, this is how government's supposed to work in the first place, that they would have to actually create a budget that the states would abide by and say, yeah, we accept that. And then that would go, then they would send that budget off to, this is how much we need, and then that would translate into a tax so that that year, the funding for that year would be funded. And that's how it's done. That's how the federal government should have been doing things. But here's the beautiful thing that they didn't do this. Madison basically stated, hey, we're creating a government that is designed to protect you with deadly force. This government is external facing. They understood the dangers of having the guns turn inwards towards the people. So that you want your government to actually, your internal government, to not be armed. You want your government to actually be cooperative and working and not with deadly force. So that these councils can actually create, like I said, an amendment where they can actually get what is necessary to be done and actually serve the union without the federal government selling us downriver. That makes sense?
Yes, sir.
And so what are your thoughts on that? I mean, this is really just high level until you really look at this, you know, on paper, which takes time to do. I believe that these are the conversations. And I think I might have mentioned this in other meetings because folks, Sean and I have talked in other meetings and so forth, where we talk about, you know, 101, you know, to 505, these different detailed levels. And a lot of times we only get a chance to talk at the 101 level, the introductory level. And I believe that when the states actually start taking their, you know, their role seriously and they start stepping in and holding the federal government accountable, this is when they can actually start having those more adult conversations, those more mature, more detailed conversations of what they need to do. And I believe that with the people engaged and involved, then there's no doubt in my mind we can literally take what the spirit of our Creator gave our framers, He can give us, and actually help us create this government for the evils that are in the world to be able to make us, what's the best way of saying it, to make us a haven. And, you know, in a very evil world where, you know, we can actually convince these other nations to abandon, you know, the forms of government and the evils that they've been embracing to come into the land of liberty, to become directly tied to where the Constitution becomes the world governing document instead of this abomination UN and Bill Gates and these monarchs of the world who are basically trying to kill us. You know, I heard this a long time ago, and forgive me, we got 1 minute left, and I'll give you a parting comment. I was told, and this has actually come out to facts, if you took all the agricultural land that we're locking down not using and all the agricultural land that's used for riotous living like tobacco, for alcohol, and all these things, we have more than enough food to not only take care of the people, the population of the earth, more than enough. To take care of them, to where we could grow exponentially, because we have the ability to create that. But instead, we're doing a contrary, and we're actually creating food and creating products to kill people. They're trying to kill us. And so, you know, however you slice it, we have a righteous path forward. We have an opportunity to do this. And you have to wake up and realize that we've been put on a path that's taking us off a cliff. And so your final comments, whatever. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sean.
Oh, thank you, GR. Honored to be here with you.
Any comments, though, regarding, you know, I've kind of parted some curtains for you. Never heard some of this stuff before. So,
well, I know when you were talking about the transportation issue, that was one of the things that got me starting to think about politics, because a long time ago, I learned that in the state of Louisiana, they had come up with a new, in experimenting and stuff, they came up with a new use for old used tires by crushing them and creating these pellets. And if they lay down a bed of the pellets before they put down the blacktop road, it increases the life of the road by like 10 times. Okay. what their normal process is.
Wow.
And I'm like, well, why don't we do this? Because it lowers the cost, it lowers the maintenance. Well, it was because, and I might be explaining this wrong, but if you don't spend all of the money that the federal government gives you for highways, the next time you don't get as much. So yep. It's like a constant self-perpetuating corruption.
Yep. There you go. And so sorry about that. I'll let you close that concept out because I know exactly what you're talking about. And so we ran out of time. Folks, we have to get – we have a self-governing system, and it's a beautiful system, but it is rampant with corruption because we're not in it. I'm GR Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.